We will all get there someday, but we still don't like talking much about the end of life. If we're lucky, as in not surprised, we'll have a little time at the end to think and talk about the things we put off. Our guest this hour thinks and talks about them all the time. Fred Gruey is a board-certified chaplain quite familiar with the end of life. He not only works with dying people, he gives presentations on what he does and what we all can do. This Thursday at the Smullen Center in Medford, he'll talk about legacy of words, discerning your life's meaning and passing it along to your loved ones. It's part of a series offered by COHO, which stands for Choosing Options, Honoring Options. Fred Gruey, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Jeffrey, it's my pleasure.
This is not a line of work for everyone, clearly. What opened the door for you?
I would say two experiences. My mother died when I was about 22. She was 44 after a seven-year battle with cancer. And I had just graduated college, and I moved home to help care for her at the end. She was spent the last year in a lot of pain on the couch in our family room. And I moved home dumber than dirt, and caring for her for the last few months of her life was hard, but it was one of the richest experiences of my life. My mom taught me I had a strength and sensitivity in me I didn't know I had. And so it was hard, but it was a rich experience. And then in the early 90s, one of my best friends died of AIDS, and we helped care for him for the last 3 years of his life. And that was, once again, an incredibly hard experience. But I look back at those two experiences as two of the richest, most shaping experiences of my whole life. And so I've been a minister my whole life, and I like this work.
Particularly with your mom, I mean, was there a certain level of, youthful ick factor in there or something? Like, I don't want to be around somebody who's dying or something. But obviously, since it was your mom, you really couldn't quite get away with that, could you?
No, you know, Jeffrey, there wasn't really not so much an ick factor because, you know, you get into it. It's not like you think about it. It's like the frog in the kettle. You know, the heat just keeps going up and you just keep adapting, and you really can't, you don't have time to just stop and think about stuff. You just do what needs done. And so, yeah, I mean, it was, and I often tell the families that I work with, this is hard. It's not easy. But just because it's hard doesn't mean it's bad. It can be really beautiful and rich. This is one of the crazy things about being with dying people. It doesn't always happen, all right, but often it creates a space for intimacy that you never really experienced with that person before. I once was with a really intelligent, well-educated CEO, a lady. And she was telling me that her father died of a protracted illness, and she cared for him. And it was so, her experience was much like mine. It was very rich because her father had always been much larger in her life, you know, this big figure. And as he began to decline, he had needs, and she was able to meet those. And so it created this intimacy that she had longed for with her dad all her life. And so it was hard but rich. And then, interestingly, I think it was a short time after that, her husband was tragically killed in an accident, and she felt cheated that she didn't get to have that intimacy with him that she had gotten with her father. And so, you know, it doesn't always happen, but the potential is there, and it can be really beautiful.
There's a real changing of roles and boundaries, it sounds like, in those situations, particularly the one where you mentioned with the woman and her father. This, because the pretenses are dropped, you know, the high-powered executive, it doesn't matter at
Jeffrey,
this point.
Jeffrey, that's, as a minister, that's what I love about being a hospice chaplain. There's no BS. You know, by the time somebody comes on to hospice, the BS is kicked out of them, and you talk about the really important stuff. You talk about meaningful things, and it's so rich. I mean, you know, as a pastor or minister, you'll hear, you know, why do we sing the same songs every Sunday? Or somebody was sitting in my pew, or, you know, if we got out 20, you know, if the sermon was 10 minutes shorter, we could beat the Baptist to all the good restaurants. And when you're in hospice, you don't have to put up with that kind of stuff.
It's all just stripped away and right down to its basic human essence.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that a hard message to get across to people, though? I mean, people do. Is it a fear of death or just a fear of the emotional pain that the families think they'll feel with death? Because when I gather from other people I've talked to, it's less of a concern for the people dying. They've kind of gotten the message.
Jeffrey, you know, that's a great point. Often the work of the hospice team is helping the family catch up to where the patient already is. Often the patient is aware that their mortality is coming quickly, and often they've made peace with that. It's the rest, everybody else, that's sort of freaking out. And yeah, you know, it's a complex thing. There's still a lot of mystery to it. What we don't understand scares us. And so, you know, but for me, I like talking about it because it helps me. Well, in the last 9 years, I've been with about 1,000 folks that have died.
Really, that many?
And I've learned so much about how I want to live now. Like, that's really important. And, yeah, so.
I've heard it said that nobody ever said on their deathbed they wish they'd spent more time at the office. After being with 1,000 people.
That's my experience. Nobody said they've ever wanted to spend more time online or watch more football. I've never heard those. In fact, it was last week or 2 weeks ago, within the last 2 weeks, I was with this gentleman who for the last 10 years has lived with his daughter and her husband in their home. He had his own room in their home, and they cared for him. And he was very near the end, could hardly talk anymore, was losing his speech. And his daughter was there, and she was crying. She had done a wonderful job of caring for him. And he's holding on to her, and I can read his lips, and he's saying, "You're all I have, you're all I have." And she's crying. "Jeffrey, it was so holy, it was so beautiful. It was a privilege to be in the presence of that. But at the end, what matters is the people that we love. You know, everything else, you just realize how all the stuff we get worried about, like who's going to win the elections or who's going to make it into the Super Bowl next year, it's just silliness. What really matters is the people that we love and giving them of who we are. That's the juice."
Fred Gruey is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a board-certified chaplain often working with dying people in hospice and their families. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the subject matter. Fred will also deliver his conversation about dying called Legacy of Words, Discerning Your Life's Meaning and Passing It Along to Your Loved Ones. That'll be Thursday at 2 and at 7 at the Smullen Center in Medford. You can join us here and now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I understand you've continued your education in this area, is that right?
I'm working on a doctorate now, and I want to give a big thank you to Providence Hospice, who is helping pay for my doctorate. That's who I work for, and they are a very kind and generous group. But I'm working on, and particularly on this issue, because of the federal regulations for hospice care, it's changed drastically in the last few years. So now people are in hospice service generally for much shorter periods of stay because the government doesn't want to pay too much for it. And so of the 1,000 folks I've been with, look, not everybody has difficulty in dying. I want to say that up front. Not everybody does. But of the people that do, the biggest thing I encounter is, why am I still here? Why won't God take me? I'm ready to go. This is awful. You know, I just want to go. It's generally folks that are bedbound. They really can't do much anymore. And they feel bad because they're burning up their family's resources of money and energy, people staying off work to stay home to care for them. And in our culture, I think the great fear, you talked about the fear of all this, one of the great fears is being a burden to somebody else. I call that the great American mortal sin. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be a burden to anybody else. And so you're laying in a bed, you don't feel there's a reason to be here. So I've been working with trying to develop non-pharmaceutical tools to help alleviate this existential pain at the end of life, this loss of meaning. And what I'm learning is I need to go further upstream, because by the time folks get into hospice care, A lot of their mental acuity is compromised because of the pain and the side effects of the medications or the disease process. And so I'm putting together for my doctoral work a 5-week workshop on discerning your life's meaning. What is it you've learned in your life? And how would you package that to pass on to your loved ones before you go? So think of it like some people call it an ethical will, but it's not about ethics, big ethics. It's about your own personal ethic. But so that when the day comes and a doctor does tell you, all right, you're looking at 2 or 3 months. So instead of running around trying to think, what was my life about? What did I do? You have a working project that you can fall back on to share with the people that you love. And it's a gift you can give them before you go. Here's what I've learned in life. This is what was important to me. Or in another part of that is, here's what I see in you that's beautiful and special. Like your father, you know, on his deathbed, looks at you and says, son, here's why I'm so proud of you. I see this in you. You can do this. What a gift. Or daughter, you know, I love how sensitive you are and how you nurture and care. What a gift to be able to take. And it helps the person that's dying get the attention off of their own self and onto the people they love. So anyway, that's the kind of stuff I'm working on.
When I think about people thinking about the end of life in advance, there's certainly a level of fear there.
Yeah.
There's certainly a level of distaste there. Nobody really wants to think about their own demise.
Right.
Given those, is there also a level of just disability that we're really not able to think about the end of life? We really can't picture what it's like to be there. You know, I just got weeks or days ahead and all this time behind me.
I think, you know, Jeffrey, as I've studied, it's really a cultural thing. That's a North American cultural or Western cultural thing. In other parts of the world, one of the things I like in Japan, there are some Zen practitioners that write death poems. Some of those are called haikus. Now, not all haikus are death poems, but they work on them every day because you never know when your last day is going to be. So you want to have, and so you think about it. For me, what it's about I think, not that I'm obsessed with it, but I want to think about, how do I want to live now while I still have time and energy to do what I want to do and to express to the people that I love that I love them? Because none of us knows for... Look, here's the reality. We're all dying. I've read a quote once that I love. Life is a terminal disease.
Right.
You know, and it always ends in death. But... The folks I meet in hospice, they're the ones that are aware of it. The rest of us are in denial. And so I just, all right, one day it's going to be me. How do I want to live now? I want to live as richly as I can right now. So that's what I love about my job. It always reminds me, what am I doing now? Because life is a gift.
Fred Gruey, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a board-certified chaplain, often working with the dying and their families in hospice. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange if you have questions or comments about this whole process. Maybe there have been some experiences that you have been around to witness that really moved you. Join us at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email might be better for this particular subject, and that's jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned that because of regulations and insurance and all that sort of thing, that the hospice stays are getting shorter.
Yeah.
What did they used to be, and what are they ending up to be now? And first of all, let me reestablish, hospice can be at home too, right? It's not just
hospice,
a place to stay.
Hospice is generally always at home. It's not at the hospital. I mean, people go on. The idea is that hospice actually would save money to the whole medical system because you're not in a hospital. You're either where you know, in an adult foster home, your own home, a nursing facility, or whatever your living situation is, and you receive care there, which is much less expensive than trips to the ER or being in an intensive care unit. And I think, you can Google to get the exact number of days, but it used to be, I think, people would be on for maybe 2 or 3 months. And now I think the length of stay is getting down to like 3 weeks or something. And there have been studies that the longer people are on hospice care, there's actually less depression experienced by the survivors afterwards. But it's just a numbers game. You know, the number of dollars that hospice out of the federal budget has ballooned, and so they're freaking out, and so they want to shut. You know, it's politics, it's money, it's power, it's all that stuff. So it's hard.
As a minister, I mean, granted, you're looking at things that affect the human spirit, but then when it gets down to dollars and cents, does that ever put a real cramp in your style?
Look, I'm a Christian minister, but I read a lot of Taoist and Zen stuff, and I work with what I've got. You know, I'm not going to change all of that. I don't want to. I just try to do the best. My goal, whenever I'm working with a family, is that everything's just a little better because I showed up than if it wouldn't have been. So I just have a more localized view. You know, that stuff doesn't get to me too much.
In the cases where you've got some time to work with the people who are dying and their families, is it often cancer? Is that often the slower decline that gives people some time to think before they really start losing faculties?
There's a lot of different cancers, but the dementia things are big, and that's always hard because the mental capacity to think changes over the course of the disease process so radically. And then there's a lot of COPDs and all that kind of stuff. The hardest ones for me are the really slow debilitating diseases like Parkinson's and MS and that stuff, where people have had to fight so long every inch of the way that at the end, the surrendering part is really hard because you've had to fight for years and years and years.
Interesting. So it really is a transition of the fight. Instead of fighting against it to live and live a meaningful life,
right,
now you're saying, okay, now I'm not going to fight it anymore.
You know, here's my experience. All right. This is just one guy's experience with about 1,000 folks. I would say the people that fight the hardest against the dying process have the most pain. Unless some people have a tumor pressing against the nerve, that creates a lot of pain. That has nothing to do with it. But except for those kinds of cases, the people that fight the hardest, why me? This isn't fair. Their pain is a lot higher and they need more medications. The folks that have, you know, from a Buddhist or Taoist or Zen sort of perspective, that can just sort of accept and go with the flow, generally have a much easier time. But here's the hard part. How do you know when, you know, because some things you just need to fight and want to fight. Knowing when to surrender, when to yield, that's the wisdom that's really, that's tough.
Is there an age by which you recommend that people think about what life meant to them? In other words, not to necessarily go all the way to the death haikus every day, but to at least begin to think about what life means to you long before perhaps you get to a point where you're faced with the end of it.
Yeah, I think, you know, there have been a number of psychologists that have written a lot about, you know, what they call the stages of life. And I think that's a latter stage of life thing. The word legacy is a big deal for people in, you know, I would say north of the mid-60s, that legacy becomes an important word. And so you want to think about what it is you've learned that you really do want to pass on. And I do want to, this is my favorite quote. I use this a lot. This is from Aeschylus, the dramatist who created
ancient Greece. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 800 before the Common Era, who really developed drama theater. I mean, he was the creator of tragedy. At any rate, there's this wonderful line in his play Agamemnon where he writes, "He who learns must suffer, and even in our sleep, pain that cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, and in our own despair against our will comes wisdom to us by the awful grace of God." And what Aeschylus tapped into, this is so profound to me, is the rhetorical question here is, can a person become wise without suffering? And Aeschylus would say no. And so I think the legacy that we can pass on, look back over our life at those periods where we really experience some suffering, that's where our wisdom lies. And that's the treasure that we have to pass on to the people that we love.
That's a great nugget in there. Against our will comes wisdom to us.
Yes. Against
kicking
our
and screaming. Yes,
yes, yes. Now, and I want to say, not all suffering creates wisdom, but it creates an environment where wisdom can happen. You know, there is some suffering that's just, we never get anything out of it, and that's really sad.
The presentation you're making on Thursday, again, 2 and 7 at the Smullen Center at the campus of Asante Rogue Regional Medical Center in Medford, sponsored by COHO, Choosing Options, Honoring Options.
Yeah.
So the person who is dying is the one choosing the options, and the family is honoring those options. Is that the general split?
Yeah. I mean, that COHO, is, I'm sure you know, is a grassroots sort of effort by a lot of community members. I think one of the founding leaders was Dr. John Forsyth, and our current directors are Diane Kotsmaka of Providence Hospice, where I work, and Adi Goldberg of Asante Health System. So Adi and Diane are leading the ship now. But and this is the important part of the COHO effort. The COHO effort was to help people fill out advance directives in pulse form so families would know what a person wants if and when they become uncommunicative. But the important part here is the conversation. The conversation is more important than the paperwork, because the paperwork is static and it's sterile. And if you fill out an do we need to go?
Go ahead.
All right.
You have time to finish.
All right. So if you fill out an advance directive and you end up in a hospital and one of your children comes and says, no, 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 if you do that, I'll sue you. The whole thing, the paperwork is null and void. So having the conversation with your loved ones, that's the most important thing. And that's the effort of COHO.
All right. Fred Gruey is a board-certified chaplain working with people who are in many stages of dying. 1,000 people over 9 years. Thanks so much for sharing your perspective with us. Great to have you.
Thank you.
That'll do it for this hour of the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening.